Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. This morning, we're welcoming Emily Pullen from Jim's Jerky, and it's great to have you along. We had Emily speak to the Angus community at the World Angus Forum. We had a business breakfast, and a few people get to hear a story, but not enough. So we thought it was a great opportunity to have Emily come along and talk on the podcast about it's really a great business that you've got, Emily, and it's a great story for our members. So thank you for being a part of it.
No, thank you for having me.
Emily, just to set the scene, we've got members all over Australia and New Zealand, so certainly our Queensland members, probably our New South Wales members know your brand very well, but maybe some of the South mightn't be as familiar. So tell us a little bit about Jim's Jerky.
Yep, sure. So Jim's Jerky recently celebrated its 21st birthday. Unfortunately, no kegs, but we did have a nice time with some cake. So we started in 2004. So it was started by my parents, Jim and Kathy. For, I think, 30 years, they were mixed grazing and cropping enterprises on the Northern Downs and near Ralston in central Queensland. We were all, so three kids, we were all at boarding school and university down in the southeast corner here. And mum and dad sold their partnership in central Queensland and were looking for the next stage of what to do. And dad had this great idea that he should go up to the Northern Territory and farm peanuts. And mum thought that she probably didn't want to go to the Northern Territory and farm peanuts. So they compromised and came to Toowoomba. And there was a butcher shop on the outskirts of Toowoomba, a little village called Charlton, that was for sale. And dad, you know, wasn't a butcher but had plenty of on-farm butchering experience. So thought that might be an interesting business. And the business was actually owned by a South African gentleman who was drying some biltong in a small little chamber in the back of the butcher shop. Dad had never heard of biltong before. So biltong's a South African dried meat, and it's a dry spiced and slow dried product. And Dad tried it for the first time. He went, wow, this is what beef really should taste like. Because the beef jerkies at the time were quite sugary and quite highly processed. And you know, he felt a long way from what Australian steak should be. And so I think it was a bit of a revelation. So that's what got him across the line.
And that's how Jim's Jerky kicked off.
That's how it kicked off. So they bought the butcher shop and closed down the wholesale butchering part and concentrated on starting to make beef jerky. Because Dad thought, if I like this so much, and I'm not necessarily a jerky fan, I reckon other people will. But it was quite a mad thing to do, really, because they had no experience in food or FMCG, fast-moving consumable goods at all.
It's incredible, really. And so from that quite modest start, what does Jim's Jerky look like today?
Yeah, so, so there's quite a classic story that has become family law now that in the first month they made 12 kilos of beef jerky. And on where our shop is at the moment, it's on the Warrego Highway, which is quite a busy highway and a route west from sort of Brisbane and Toowoomba. And there were cars roaring up and down, and Dad had made this jerky. He was very proud of it. And he's like watching the cars roar up and down the Warrego Highway going, oh, how am I going to sell this now? So fast forward 20 odd years, we've got a team of 28. We have done some exporting. We're in some retail in Australia, and the business has significantly grown since those days.
Yeah, it's a bit of an icon, isn't it, for people that Queenslanders will know your shop front, which is on the highway there, and it's a frequent stopping point for people there. But is it a retail presence like supermarkets? Is that, I think you did mention at the World Forum how many outlets you have. It's quite significant.
Well, we're certainly probably one of the challenger brands in Australia, challenging those big sort of global multinational brands, which is a couple. So we're in Woolworths in Queensland, and we're in quite a few national petrol and conveniences like United, Puma, Caltex. So those are our big footprint, and then we've got a lot of sort of smaller footprint, independent supermarket and retail, and we're still striving to get ourselves in more places for more people.
And what about overseas? Where have you exported to?
So we're currently exporting to Vietnam, Hong Kong and Singapore, and we're testing the market in South Korea and Japan as well. So basically places where Australian beef has a really fabulous reputation. The work of, you know, the Australian Beef Friends, Meat and Livestock Australia, to really place Australian beef at the forefront in some of those Asian marketplaces. We're just sort of moving that slightly sideways and saying it's also a great snack product. And, you know, as we know, Australian products have a fantastic health halo and sort of a, you know, the good green halo as well. So we're sort of leading into that in that space, and it's going quite well.
That's fantastic. People mightn't know that my first roll out of college, or to Gatton College, and then worked in Singapore in a food business there. And yeah, we imported a lot of products from around the world, but a lot of Australian product. And at that stage, it was Asia, with Southeast Asia particularly, was like the hot spot for the government encouraging small businesses to do business there. And yeah. Singapore is a wonderful centre, but they love Australian product. There's quite a good connection, so we hope it continues to grow in those markets. That's a great opportunity.
Yeah, it's one of the things that you know, we're very fortunate in Australia, and being an SME, a small to medium business, we get a lot of support from various government groups, and they're always like, "Have you guys thought of exporting? You should export." And as a meat business, it's quite a process to become export registered. So we took the leap to go ahead and move into export. So there's just a lot of bookwork, essentially. I won't be telling your listeners anything you don't know about having to put in systems and bookwork and things like that. So, and we got our export accreditation at the end of 2019, right before COVID hit. So we've probably taken a bit longer to really infiltrate the markets, but we've sort of taken that sort of laser approach now, like, where do we want to grow, and targeting markets where we think we're going to have the best cut through.
Excellent. Emily, our members there, we've got 4,000 members around Australia. We've got about 1,000 seed stock producers that have stud Angus cattle, and then we've got a lot of commercial Angus producers as well. They'll be wanting to know, what cuts do you use? Do you take carcasses? Do you buy particular cuts that are bulk some beef? Yeah, what's the import that you use?
We only use one cut. I wish that there was animals with only this cut on it, so get onto it, breeders. Topside. So topside, as you guys will know, is a butt cut, so it runs down the rump of the animal. The reason we love it is it actually makes for terrible steak, but great jerky and biltong, because it has a very little intramuscular fat. So we want a really lean cut of meat. It has no seams, so it's a very clean whole muscle. We take the topside, we trim it of any fat on the outside, so you've got a really nice clean piece of red meat. The reason we don't like fat is fat doesn't dry. So you get a really nice dry on protein, but fat doesn't dry, and it can become rancid over time. So that's that kind of unpleasant kind of off sort of smell and taste that you can get, particularly with products that are high in oil. So it can also happen to nuts and things like that. So rancidity is not what we're looking for, particularly when we want shelf life of 12 months. So we take our topside. We slice it at 12 millimetres for jerky, for example, 24 for biltong. We put it in a tumbler with a dry spice, and then we just dehydrate it sort of low and slow. So topside is king. And look, we've been going for 21 years, and one of the things that we've really seen is products like topside, which you would consider a secondary primal, didn't have much excitement in the market sort of 15, 20 years ago. They were manufacturing meat, you know, it was pretty cheap, really, and very plentiful. And what we've seen over the last, I would say, probably 8 years is that sort of lean manufacturing meat really starting to take a forefront position, because we're all trying to work out better value from the carcass and finding new ways. So we've actually seen topside become quite an important cut, particularly into export markets and other manufacturing. So we're having to fight for our topside. So overall, great news for the red meat industry. But at the moment, it's making us think about what other products we can make with other up-and-coming cuts, I suppose, because our favourite is a real favourite now.
Yeah, excellent. I mean, it's very important to use all the cuts in through the animal. And I guess our breeders are working very hard to increase marbling and intramuscular fat. But, yeah, as a bit of a home butcher at times, it is a good cut, and it's interesting, and it's great for our industry that it's got a real usefulness there. Is it getting more expensive over the 25 years? I imagine you've seen the cost of that input increase quite a lot as a proportion to other cuts.
Definitely. So I've been with the business for 10 years, so I've only been on half of the journey, but plenty of, you know, impromptu family board meetings around what's been going on. So Jim sort of says for the first 10 to 12 years, the price of the topside really tracked with the ecchi, so at about $3 more. So whatever the ecchi was sitting at, we'd be paying about $3 more for our topside. And so that, you know, made decision-making around buying and things quite, you know, it didn't change for 10 years. Then right around 2019, so some will remember that was a really terrible time for the dry, particularly up in sort of Queensland and New South Wales. And at the same time, African swine fever hit China and basically took out their entire protein over about a three-month period. And there became a real vacuum for protein. So a huge amount of products started to be exporting. And we really saw a complete dislocation from what the farm gate price was to what the markets were doing. So I think at the time, farmers and graziers prices were probably some of the lowest they'd ever seen, but we were paying the highest prices that we'd ever paid. I think we had about a 35% increase in our raw materials over about a three-month period during that time.
Yeah, that's huge, isn't it?
Absolutely. Like, I mean, we could, you know, if we could get the meat, we were paying, you know, upwards of $13, $14, whereas our market had been sort of stable around $8 or $9 or even $7.50. And I think, you know, it was a perfect storm of the environment for what was going on. And, you know, we, even as domestic beef consumers, we are tied to what's happening in the global markets because Australia's a net exporter of all of our protein anyway. So I really think since that period, there's been a real decoupling from what's happening domestically with meat prices to what the environment we're in. And we're in another quite high cycle now because of the disruption that the American system is having on global food. So Trump putting tariffs on Brazil has impacted how much Australian meat is actually going into that market. You know, the ructions between China and the USA mean that our meat's going to different places for different pricing. So it's been quite a roller coaster as a, you know, as a domestic consumer, that's for sure.
I imagine it has been. And that was a question I was going to ask is how elastic is, I imagine you're a manufacturer, so you've got these inputs which can swing wildly, can't they, in price? And then you've got a retail product that really probably is it fair to say not very elastic?
Yeah, there's no elasticity there. So that's one of the challenges that we face, and it's a constant job so trying to buy product as far ahead as possible, lock in prices. You know, you have to be a little bit of a looking into your magic ball to see what you think's going to happen. But we try and lock in as far in advance for our raw material supply. But then when you're working with supermarkets and big national retailers, they have at least a 12-week price. So if I wanted to change my price with Woolworths, for example, I've got a 12-week period before I can make that change. And if the meat price goes up significantly in that time, I just have to wear that. But I also have to prove that the pricing has changed enough for them to accept the price. So it's a little bit of a dance to know when you pull the trigger on, you know, hedging how much longer the price is going to stay. Is it going to fall? So that's a dance that we're still getting our feet around.
Very tricky space to operate, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's the same, you may not like to comment, but is there a difference between your independents, like IGAs? Is there a, I guess, independent owners, is that easier to handle that elastic nature, or is a consumer willing to pay X dollars and that's it?
I think so. Each business unit has its own unique sort of requirements around your pricing. Some are more flexible than others, and I would say the independents probably have a little bit more flexibility, and they probably have a little bit more flexibility around pricing. And, you know, supermarkets, when people go into shops with their shopping hat on, they do behave differently. So I think even if you think about yourself, if you're going into a supermarket, you're doing your weekly shop budget in mind, you're probably buying things on special and that sort of thing. Whereas if you're in a convenience store or a petrol store, you've just put, you know, $150 in your car, grabbing a quick snack for your four-hour drive, you don't have that same pricing sort of hat on. So the prices in those retail outlets, petrol and convenience, tend to be 10 to 15% higher than they are in retail, which is quite an interesting. But there's also some extra costs around the route to market and how you get them places. So it's a whole exercise sort of working out how you get your products. I think where you've got a consumer shopping in different places will have different ceilings for what they're willing to pay. And your category manager, who these are the people who do the buying for those stores, generally have a pretty good idea around what will fail, because it doesn't hit that the pump test really for what someone's willing to pay for a product.
Interesting. Yeah. You've got a consumer, I guess the classic jerky consumer would be a middle-aged male, probably myself, someone like that loves jerky. Is the market changing because it's a very healthy product? So yeah. Is it where's the growth in the jerky market? Yeah. Is that a different consumer now?
It certainly is. It's amazing when you look at the marketplace that we inhabit now. Jim and Kath, in deciding to set up a jerky business 20 years ago, have actually stumbled into a high protein, you know, low fat, very healthy, very clean place. But they just knew that they liked red meat. But we are stumbling into now this place where we talk about functional snacks, protein snacks. You know, there's a whole movement around protein, slightly out of date, but still worth repeating. I think it was 2020. They did a supermarket survey on overall grocery growth, and I think it was something like the whole grocery sector grew 2%, but products that made a protein claim had grown 23%. So yogurt that said it had protein, muesli bars, you know, those protein balls that are 35% sugar but still have protein in them. They're just a really big growing market for that. And so we're in the middle of that. So I would say our demographic is definitely probably skews male, certainly in that 18 to sort of 55 age group. But we're seeing a real emergence of particularly young women that are taking an interest in our kind of products. We're also learning about something called brand architecture, which is about how you meet your market and becoming more granular with your branding. So Jim's Jerky on this brand wheel, and if there's marketing people out there, please excuse me because I'm going to poorly explain this. But on a brand wheel, you have different types of brands. So there's hero brands, there's adventurer brands, there's nurturing brands, and that's a sort of a brand architecture of how people feel about the product. And Jim's falls very much into an everyman brand. So we're very much of the people, and you feel good when you're eating it, but it's not too out there or too wild or anything like that. Very poorly explained, but it's that sort of brand. But what might work if we were to want to get more women, for example, to try our products, is we might put out a different type of brand that feels more nurturing, or one that feels more aligned with health, and that might be a slightly different brand to what the Jim's is. So we're just exploring that at the moment. We know that this is the kind of product that, for example, people who are interested in health and protein and functional foods might look for, but when they look at Jim's Jerky and the branding that we have, they might not necessarily identify with it. So how do we put together a brand that feels like them and like something they'll grab off the shelf? And so we're exploring that at the moment around how we broaden our appeal around a branding perspective. Now, quite honestly, 15 years ago, we probably just would have gone, oh, it's just jerky, just bloody buy the jerky. But now, particularly getting into a really e-commerce heavy marketplace now, where people try and functionally find the brands that feel like them, and they will put a lot of brand loyalty into that. So that's kind of, I guess, the next horizon for us as a business, is how we take what is the same sort of product but package it and market it in a way that connects with a new type of consumer.
Interesting. It's fascinating. How do you stay abreast of, well, how do you learn about marketing as a CEO? What do you do to learn this type of framing, I guess?
Yeah, well, look, I'll definitely say I'm learning a lot as we go. I think you know, one of the things that Jim says, if you stand still, you get run over. And so whilst we've built a really great, and people are very loyal to our brand, we also know that in a marketplace which is ripe for growth, where people are looking for high protein, functional, better for you snacks, we need to understand that market more. So we're actually looking at working with Meat and Livestock Australia on some projects around this. They're obviously have you know, a huge amount of knowledge and information behind them to sort of tap into those macro and micro trends, both in Australia and globally. So we can work with them to get a little bit of market insight. And then just spending a lot of time looking at what's out there in the marketplace. Anyone who's on social media will understand how algorithms work, where if you take an interest in something, it'll just keep feeding it to you. So my Instagram is just full of, you know, influencers around protein, influencers around health, different protein brands, both Australian and overseas. And so I'm already in that world and sort of seeing what's out there and what seems to be making its mark, and we'll try and sort of find out our niche in there as well. So I think probably the next stage for us will be, you know, keeping our gyms brand going really well, but then looking at other ways we can find homes for high protein snacks.
Excellent. That's fantastic. Do you see that sector like continuing to grow in terms of that high value beef product going forward?
Absolutely. I think like we've just seen a huge amount of new brands popping up, particularly in the last 5 years. And so that's obviously challenging for us, because for a long time we were one of the only challenger brands in the Australian like beef snack market. We had the big guys. There's an American-owned one, and then a pretty big local one, which has now been bought by the American one. So there was already beef jerky in the marketplace. But I would say 20 years ago when we first started up, there were probably two or three other significant challenger brands that have all sort of started making their way into the Australian landscape. And so, but recently we've seen a real proliferation of new brands. And whilst that obviously feels challenging for someone who's in the market, it also means that there is more room for high protein Australian beef snacks, and a rising tide takes all ships, right? So there's just more people that are willing to try these products, knowing what they like. And we're already seeing, particularly in petrol and convenience, so in that sort of convenience buying space, they have what they call bays that are dedicated to certain products. So they have a chip bay, they have a chocolate bay, they have, you know, the different bays. And alternative snacks was sort of one small bay, and in there you'd find your jerky, your nuts, your pretzels, sort of like your alternative snacks. Those bays are now 3 and 4 and are eating into the chip bay, because the way that people snack is changing. And anyone who's done road trips, and I imagine a lot of listeners do a lot of miles, if you're going in and you're looking at, you know you shouldn't be buying a packet of lollies. What else can I buy that's going to satiate me but also be good for me and make me not feel guilty? And that's the place where we live. So as that becomes more prominent, we're just going to see more and more brands, and that can only be good news for growing the Australian beef jerky market.
That's fantastic. And that's good news for the industry, really.
It is, yeah.
It's excellent. It's a healthy product. I do help out the industry a little bit.
Thank you for your support.
Yeah, that's great. We don't often get to ask somebody that's got a really good sense of marketing, but a lot of our listeners that would be listening to this podcast, they've got strong brands around their seed stock operations, their Angus studs, essentially. Have you got any marketing wisdom that you would see the type of environment, I guess, from afar that our guys are trying to position their brands in? What's a couple of lessons that you might have, Emily?
Well,
someone trying to grow their brand.
Yeah, I feel like I'm really going to be telling some experts here how to suck eggs. So, look, I think one of the things that we're discovering and we're not very good at yet but need to get better at is you have your product, which for us is a packet of beef jerky that sits on a shelf, and for your listeners will be your seed stock or your progeny or your bulls and your heifers. But a lot of, I think, where we're going now with the marketing is actually telling the story behind that product. So I think the really successful brands that are doing this well are giving a little bit of a peek behind the scenes around, you know, what goes into making that product. So I guess one of the things that we're trying to do now is talking a little bit more about how you make that product. Where does the meat come from? What's the importance of the meat? You know, what sort of spices are we using? You know, for us, we've got some really important call-outs around protein. So, you know, we're just about 50% protein for our products. That's very high. You know, we use certain spices. They're gluten-free. Why is that important? You know, here's our team. Here's them working. Here's the hands behind the work. And there's a certain connection there to the food and how it's made and what sets you apart from like a really, for us, a high ultra processed, you know, chip or something. Here's why it's different and here's why it's important. So I guess if you're going to put that onto the type of businesses that are in the beef world, well, is it worth doing a little bit of like, here's who we are as a business, here's the things that are important to us, here's some of our husbandry or, you know, temperament's important. Here's why, here's our long line of breeding that's meant that we're very, you know, we've got fantastic MSA scores or something. I'm talking a little bit out of my school here, guys, but I guess that's one of the successful things is like setting up the brand for being more than just that front facing and looking a little bit back behind.
No, I think you're right. I look all the time and we've got, look, I think it's about 300 sales a year of Angus animals and different types of categories, but a lot of bull sales, obviously. But I do see that is that those people that are great marketers do manage through the course of the year to sell their story and so that someone buying their animals or the genetics has a very clear idea about what that business stands for and what their breeding objectives are. I think, it's some really good wisdom there. Yeah.
And it's just, it makes you part of the story then. And I think there's a little bit of ownership there for consumers to understand where it comes from. Now, I say that heavily caveated that we're not doing that very well yet, but we'll eventually get Jim on camera.
That's great. Well, it looks good from the outside. Emily, just to change tack now, I guess one of the quite moving stories that you talked about at the World Forum was, and our family had a very similar issue, I guess, 10 years ago. You had a big challenge as a manufacturer in terms of you had an industrial fire, didn't you?
And yes.
Yeah, can you tell us that story?
Yeah, Emily? Sure. So on the 4th of April 2023, I had just had a really successful meeting with some possible future partners in Brisbane, and I was driving back up to Jerky HQ, and Jim and Kath, mum and dad, were in Sydney setting up for the Sydney World. And I have this amazing memory of driving along the Warrego Highway and giving them a quick call and saying something along the lines of, break out the champagne, we've got a yes. And so we were going to be ranged with a big company, and we were very excited about it because it was some growth. And I hung up the phone and was probably singing along terribly to some music, and I got a phone call from my office. And it was our retail junior, who I think was 15 or 16 at the time, doing an after-school shift in the shop. And she rang and she said, have you spoken to Joel, who was our QA at the time, about our food tech? And I said, oh, no. She goes, everything's on fire and I can't find him, and hung up. And I thought,
oh, my gosh.
What? What do you mean everything's on fire? It was the strangest call. And I then quickly rang Joel, who I said was our food tech, and we actually had a fire break out in our factory. And it was incredibly surreal to be talking to someone who was on site but not being able to be there and sort of and help. So we were very fortunate that it had happened late in the afternoon, so all of our production staff had left, and we only had two team members actually on site, and they were both safe straight away, which is obviously always the first concern, is who's on site, where is everyone. That safety plan kicks in. And we were also very fortunate that the Queensland Fire Service had built a brand new depot across the road from our facility, literally across the road. And their crib room, so their break room, actually faced us. And so they actually saw the smoke before the call came in. So they were already half-dressed by the time the call came in that we had a fire. So what had happened was a fan, so we've got big cold rooms that have big fans that blow air quickly across our beef jerky with some heat controls. One of the fans had essentially stopped working but had overheated and caught fire. And then that just spread from there through the dryers and took out our entire drying system. But thank goodness QFES, the fireys, got there within 12 minutes and had it put out before it got in, like properly burned down the factory. And so, you know, we were just so grateful to them for getting there. And there were accelerants. We had diesel on site and, you know, some gas bottles and stuff. So when I arrived, they had the fire completely put out. And, I, you know, there was just so many blokes there all in their, you know, fire finery, and everyone looked very professional. And I said to the, you know, the guy who was managing the scene, I said, I'm just so sorry. Like, this is, oh, goodness. And he said, oh, no, they love it. There was all the accelerants. It was all very exciting. And I was like, oh, great. I'm glad you enjoyed it. So we were very fortunate that it didn't take hold of the entire building. And so we were like, oh, well, that's fine. We can get this rebuilt really quickly. But actually, smoke is an incredibly devastating, smoke and soot is very incredibly devastating, which I had no idea. So even though we had very little heat or fire or even water damage getting to our facility, the smoke is so damaging, and it really corrodes and eats into everything. So we went through a really big period of having to go through and assess every piece of equipment for damage, and the insurers obviously had to be involved in all of that. So what we thought, Jim and I, standing there looking at the burnt out shells of the dryer, oh, she'll be right. We'll be up and going in 6 to 8 weeks. No, it took about 12 months.
Well, that's incredibly hard to take care of. Essentially, that's the major part of your production.
That's right.
Yeah. How did you cope with what do you do there? You're in a major chain supermarket. You've got shelf space that needs to be filled with product. I imagine that's the biggest issue is how do you fulfill your customers?
Yeah. So I guess you go from having a business to not having a business overnight. So the first part was wrangling with the insurers. So, you know, they've got a job to do to make sure, you know, I didn't throw a match in the back of the dryer. So once you've got through that first hurdle, you know, yes, this was a genuine fire. No, it wasn't arson, or no one, you know, came and threw a match in. You then have to deal, you've got staff who suddenly don't have anything to do. So how you manage your staff. And unfortunately, we had to lay off quite a lot of staff at that time because we just didn't have any
work.
There's no work. So that was a really terrible time. And then you've got to engage with your customers. So, you know, your big chains, your big contracts. I will say everyone was incredibly understanding, because I think if something like a fire is so visceral, it's not, oh, we can't get the meat or the spice is delayed, or
it's a crisis.
So it is, it's a crisis. And I think, you know, even the big boys, Woolies was just like, all right, you just keep us in the loop. So it was a full-time job managing the insurance, the rebuild, and communications with customers, because that's the first thing. It's like, this is what's happened. These are our timelines as we know them at the moment, and just keeping people informed. And I think that was the key, really, was if you create a vacuum of information, people will fill it. Or they will make decisions without you in mind. So just having that really, I had a group of our buyers from different businesses that I would, at the end of every week, myself and my colleague Kate would send them updates. This is what we're up to. This is the timelines. This is where we're going. So we did some crazy things. Our cold room wasn't actually impacted by smoke. So we actually set up, whilst we were still rebuilding the main processing area, we set up our manufacturing in the cold room. So we only very small batches, and we had Jim got made a small dryer that could handle about 600 kilos of meat at a time. And we just started small in the cold room, doing the manufacturing in the cold room, and then loading up this tiny little dryer. And that is how we started again. So it was a starvation diet, but we can get you this much to this customer. Yeah. And that's how we started out. So whilst we were fully rebuilding the rest of our processing, we started again from this tiny space with an amazing team who just rolled up their sleeves and were like, well, this is a bit crazy, but let's see what we can get done. And I think, you know, the necessity of invention is being challenged in that way.
Amazingly hard period. Did you maintain your shelf space, for example, in most of your retailers?
We did for our major retailers. They essentially just put up one of those tickets that said, sorry, we're out of stock. So had we gone on much longer, I think we would have been in trouble, not being able to fully fulfil our POs. But we lost a lot of our smaller contracts or our smaller stores, you know, they'll just move on to someone else. And I would say 2 and a bit years later, we are only just back to recovered our units per store per week. So our run rate of sales before the fire, we're only probably just recovering to now.
That's a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, because you've got your retailers that make the decision, but you've got your consumers to make the decision. If they're saying, well, I buy gyms every second week at my shop and we're no longer available, they'll find someone else. And so it's getting them back in.
Yeah, incredibly hard. How did you cope as a, you know, yourself personally?
I think when you're deep in something like that, you just sort of put your head down and plow through. And I think the other thing, you just triage the jobs, like what is the most important job today? What's this next most important job? And so you're kind of running on that adrenaline, but, you know, for 6 months. And so I think we got quite tired sort of after a while of just, you know, and we had some customers who probably weren't as understanding as others. And so it's dealing with them, but that's fine. They've got a business to run, you know. So probably at the end of it, we were pretty worn out. But I also want to say, like, yes, it was, you know, this big tragedy or trauma for the business, but also everyone was fine. We could rebuild. We had insurance. Like, you know, it was probably one of the better outcomes of what it could have been. But we were quite tired by the end of it. And I think now, looking back, the fact that we're still trading, the fact that we're back in growth mode now is a testament to those hard yards that we put in then. But I also go, oh, geez, how much further would we be ahead now if that hadn't happened? So that's always in the back of your mind. But that's okay. We'll just keep ploughing on.
That's great. It's a great story. It's a credit to your family that you've come through it and you, I guess, wouldn't say thriving yet, but it sounds like you're back to where you were at least.
And yeah.
What's the next phase then, Emily? Like, you've got your production back where it should be. You've got your customers back. What's the next chapter for gyms look like?
Well, we're actually in the process of building a brand new shed. So one of the things we're grappling with right before the fire was we had fully run out of capacity. We just, you know, all of our equipment was on wheels because we had to move things around to do different products and pack different things. And, you know, in a really small space, we were managing to churn out a lot of product, but it was not, you know, it was not sort of filling our needs anymore. We had containers with cardboard in it and, you know, we'd really outgrown the site we were in. But as I'm sure anyone who's in business at the moment who's listening, knowing that you need to take that next step and then knowing how to take that next step and the risk that comes with it, so whether that's employing someone new or buying some new country or investing in some genetics that are, you know, that it's going to be a big ticket item. We were sort of grappling with that. And so when the fire occurred, we were like, well, hang on, is this the point? Is this the launch point? But when we actually looked into it, the approvals and the building approvals and the timeline, and particularly post-COVID, was still, you know, quite long. We thought, well, no, to keep going, we're going to have to rebuild here. But, you know, let's start thinking about what that next phase looks like. So we've actually partnered with SunPork, which is, I think, Australia's largest pork producers. They were also looking for dehydration capacity for they've launched a new product. Again, we were just talking earlier about carcass utilization and how to get the best out of the carcass. So for them, part of their value-adding story is now pet treats and they've launched a brand called Pork Petco, and they were looking for drying capacity at the same time as we were looking for it. So our new facility is a partnership with SunPork, so it's going to be a shared facility using Jim's drying system to do our beef work and their pork work. But we've got the benefit of scaling with two businesses there. So we're in the process of finalising the build for that in partnership with SunPork. And that's very exciting because, you know, we've got this lovely new facility. After being in a 7-year-old ex-butcher shop, it feels quite daunting to be stepping into it. But also it just means that the world really opens up for us in terms of what capacity looks like. If we get a really big opportunity, we'll be able to say yes in this facility, whereas where we are now, we'd be saying, well, we can fill part of your requirement, but we're hamstrung. So we're sort of taking that leap into the next phase of growth, and it's very exciting.
That's fantastic. That's quite an opportunity. It's another good Australian company, SunPork. I've been privileged to have a look through their processing facility in Brisbane, and they're very innovative too with the way they use pig carcass in a lot of different ways. And I believe that pig's ears are the most expensive cut per kilo of a pig carcass. It's amazing utilisation.
Oh, honestly, they're obviously a much, much bigger company than us. And so there was always that trepidation of big and small, but we found them really wonderful to work with, and the common goal of getting this dehydration facility up and running. And look, we're doing exactly the same thing. We're taking great Australian protein and dehydrating it for a new marketplace and value adding to it in a really extraordinary way. They're sort of looking into that pet treat market, which we didn't have much experience with being beef jerky manufacturers. But people are willing to pay all sorts for their pets. So it's actually a really fantastic market. And actually one of the things it sort of opened our eyes to is, well, you know, there's really great market for things like pig's ears and pig snouts and things like that are already established pet treats. Well, let's look into the beef side of things. If we're looking at carcass utilization, collection of offal items that could also be used to value add. So, you know, part of our new phase is taking those lesser loved items that might end up in render or very cheaply, and how we might be able to value add to them and just lift the overall value of the carcass, and also, you know, making a really fantastic protein product as well, whether that's in the pet or human space. Like, that's part of our NPD drive for the future as well.
Might be a fascinating journey, the next chapter, by the sounds of it, Emily. It's really innovative. Do you see, where do you see the growth in terms of export markets going? Have you got a domestic focus, or are you actively looking for new export opportunities as well?
Yeah, we have a domestic focus primarily, but we absolutely are open to looking into export markets. As I sort of said, we are still a small company, so, you know, we would have to be very laser focused on, you know, where we would want to go and developing that marketplace. We've actually been doing a lot of work with Trade and Investment Queensland. So that's a Queensland government trade, and their sole job is to assist with Queensland manufacturers or Queensland exporters. So there's more and more interest in FMCG, so that's fast-moving consumable good products from Australia. And because protein snacking is a growth item here, but also in different sort of, particularly Asia, where they already do protein snacking, you know, they already, dried squid, I think, is probably the biggest protein snack consumed in Japan, for example. So they already know about protein snacking. So, you know, partnering with groups like Trade Investment Queensland and Austrade to help vet and open those doors and to start those conversations has been really helpful for us in starting that sort of export process, really.
Fantastic. We wish you all the best with that going forward. In terms of staff, you've got, was it 28 staff or something in that order?
Yeah.
It's a challenge, isn't it, running a big staff and team? Yeah, a lot of our farming members also have challenges with staff and opportunities there, and it's a big part of doing business today. That is for myself. What lessons have you learned about getting the best out of people and having a good workplace?
Yeah. Look, we're a pretty open book company, so we still run, you know, Jim and my desks are still in the open plan office. That's a space issue, but also it means that we're always present and always shoulder to shoulder with all of our team members. And the other thing is, so we've got our retail and our wholesale and our office staff, and then we've got our production staff. We're all on the same site, but obviously slightly different workplaces. But one of the things is we make sure that no one in our team is a mushroom. So if there's things that are happening, good, bad or otherwise, we'll get the team together and we'll talk about it and take everyone on the journey with us. I think there's nothing less empowering as an employee to feel like things are happening to you or happening around you without kind of understanding. So it's not necessarily that everyone will get a say in what happens, but certainly we'll let them know, you know, if we've got a new SKU into Woolworths or something, hey guys, we've been really successful and we've got this new product in. It's this product. We're going to start to need to make the product at this date. We're going to get some new packaging. We're going to do some NPD practicing with it, and then it'll start from this date. So we'll start to see a ramp up in this product from this date. So they know what's coming. They're part of it and they understand, you know, their workflows might change slightly, might be one of the reasons, or, you know, we're going to start doing a new product. It's, you know, this, I think it's just important, or it's important to us, that everyone in the team feels like they're across what's going on and they're part of the team. And so they're not just being told, hey, this is happening now. It's more like, hey, this is happening. Great to have some feedback from your boots on the ground. How do you think that'll work? Let's work together to make it a successful transition. And we, you know, through the fire as well, we had a sort of a chain of messages with our team who weren't present on site for a lot of the time, or if you found other work, but we're looking like we're going to get running again on this date. If you'd like to come back, we'd welcome you with open arms, but appreciate you might have found something else. So just open communication, feeling like they can give feedback. And oftentimes, like, if they're working actually in the facility, they can give us really valuable feedback on decision-making that we might not get if we're not on the tools every day.
Excellent. No, that's great. In terms of values, I do like to ask people on the podcast what are personal values to you, but in terms of what do you hold as a family and as yourself and your staff, what would you say would be core values at Jim's?
Yeah, look, I think one of the key ones, I never want anyone, when things go wrong, so if something gets broken or something's missed or a poor decision's made, I never want to feel like I'm going to pin someone to the wall from a blame perspective. My approach, or, you know, if things go well as well, that it's a shared win and a shared goal. So, you know, what we try and say is things go wrong, issues happen. It's like, okay, well, let's understand how that happened. You know, how could we have done it differently? What supports can we put in place to ensure that these things don't happen again, so that I don't want people to ever feel like they're scared to talk to us about things, and that we can always take learnings from some things that have gone wrong. So I guess a team first approach where we don't make anyone a scapegoat or anything like that, just have a really good team approach to it. And I guess from a family perspective with Jim and I and my mum, you know, mum and dad were founders of the business and very kindly welcomed me in 10 years ago now, and our wider leadership team. We have these sort of red wine meetings where, you know, we take it off site and then it always comes back to, well, if we do this thing, what is the worst that could happen and are we comfortable with it? So, you know, this big investment into this new facility and this partnership, well, what is the worst that can happen? Well, mum and dad have got a spare room and I do too. So if it all hits the fan, we've got somewhere to go, you know?
That's fantastic.
So I think that kind of like, are we comfortable with the worst possible outcome? Yep, right. Well, let's pin our ears back and go.
That's great. That's really good. A lot of our members would be similar to you and your dad and your mum, second generation. How did Jim and yourself, your mum, how do you interact together in that business environment? Do you separate, you know, your personal family life? I guess you do a lot of life together, don't you, really?
Yeah. No, look, if you ask my husband, we definitely do not separate work and family time, because it just comes in. But I think we always try and keep it light. You know, big things that feel big, you can sort of have those discussions, but don't let them dominate your away from work time. Look, do we have some pretty stand-up debates about things at work? Yes. But always respectfully, and, you know, Jim and I both probably have big reactions to things, but we don't hold grudges. And I think that's important, like we get over them pretty quickly. And I think importantly, we're pretty aligned on everything. So for the most part, we are both pulling in the same direction. We have a bit of a split as well. Jim works more in the operations side of things, and, you know, being an ex-farmer, ex-grazier, he's just a frustrated engineer anyway, so there's nothing that he can't fix or put together, and he certainly has skills I do not have in that area, and he just knows his drying system so well, whereas I sort of more focus on the business side of things. So we complement each other in that way, but, you know, he's a fantastic mentor for me, and, you know, we're both sort of pulling in that same direction. And yeah, but yeah, do we have disagreements sometimes, and the staff just roll it us. Righto.
It's not quite like the cattle yards, is it?
It's not quite.
Got a few onlookers things go south, but obviously from the outside looking in, you must have a really great working relationship, as it seems to be a good partnership, and it's lovely when a family can pass that wisdom, the business, the success on to the next generation, and then it's a seamless transition. Yeah. It's really important in agriculture, and obviously working well in your family.
I will say Mum and Dad did have some sort of rocky succession around, because they were both from farming families. And I think that experience of it not necessarily always going smoothly has meant that their attitude to this next succession in our business has meant that I think we're all just very aware of each other and sort of needing to give space where you've got someone with fantastic amount of experience, but also give space for someone who wants to try something different. And I think being respectfully having that at the forefront of how you interact is important.
Excellent. That's great. What's your background, Emily, before you came back into the family business? What did you do to prepare?
Much like Mum and Dad, no clue when I first came in. Probably not much now, to be honest, but I actually did agronomy at UQ Gatton and worked for a couple of years in agronomy, right in the millennial drought. So when it was not much agronomizing to be done.
Yeah. It's a great college.
Graduate. Turned out some reprobates as well. But I did that for a few years. I lived overseas for 5 years and worked in food chain assurance in the UK for 5 years for Assured Food Standards, who have the Red Tractor Kite Mark in the UK, which is about food that's grown and packed in the UK having the Red Tractor Kite Mark. So that was a really good experience across lots of different industry types in the UK in food. And then when I came back, we had that discussion. It's been going for 10 years. We probably need, are you interested? And I was like, yeah, why not? Jerky sounds fun.
That's great. What a great story. How do you keep up to date yourself? Are you a reader? Do you get many conferences? Like, how do you keep yourself sharp?
Yeah, well, a big one for me is I'm a member of the Australian Meat Industry Council called AMIC. So they're a representative group for post-farm gate. So AMIC represents processors, retail butchers and wholesale butchers and small goods manufacturers. I was fortunate to be appointed to the National Small Goods Council a couple of years ago. And so jerky is considered a small good, which was news to me. I was like, no, I'm a processor. And they're like, no, you're not. You're a small goods manufacturer.
That's great.
So that to me, being in a small business or, if you work for a really big organisations, you have access to just sort of inbuilt training and that sort of thing. Whereas when you do work in a smaller business or a family business, you can work within your family and get mentorship within your family. But I think it's really important to also put yourself in positions where you can get access to information and opinion and feedback from someone that's outside of your bubble. And so being with AMIC has really done that for me. There's some really big businesses and also other small businesses in that group. And, we're also helping sort of form policy around the post-farm gate model, which is really important. And you need to have all different types of voices around the table. For us, we're small, we're regional, we're in beef, as the other big small goods guys are all pork. So it's been really interesting. And then I was appointed to the AMIC board, was it last year or the year before? So that's again on behalf of the Small Goods Council. So
it's fantastic.
It's been really, really interesting and just fantastic for me to have that, to be in the room with some of those people. It's just amazing.
It's pretty wise minds in that room.
Yeah. So
I imagine the interactions would be really good for your personal growth.
Yeah, definitely. So it's an important sort of personal growth for me to get outside of my bubble and also give back to industry as well in any way that I can around just the experiences of being a smaller business where there are so many large businesses in the space.
That's great. That's great. Have you got a book that you think listeners should read? Any favourite business book or leadership book that you, or anything really?
Well, I was going to say, I'm actually not going to say a business book. There's plenty out there, but I love using reading as an escape. And so I've got two little kids plus the business plus everything else going on, and sometimes I just want to be able to switch the brain off a bit. And if I could recommend a book at all, there's a book called Five Bush Weddings by Claire Fletcher. So she's ex St. George girl, and she wrote her debut novel a couple of years ago, and it's just about a very, very relatable experience of going to weddings in the bush and told from the perspective of a wedding photographer. So I'm sort of a fly on the wall, and I found it very good. So I would definitely recommend that one.
Fantastic. That's great. Just a couple of questions to finish on, and we really appreciate your time. Mentors, do you have Jim might be a mentor, but have mentors been a part of your journey, and have you got a significant mentor that's helped you along the journey?
Probably not a formal mentor, but there's been some really great, I guess, people from industry. I've been lucky enough to be part of a couple of different sort of industry-based groups that have helped. So Andrew McPherson, who's the ex-CEO of Tees, has been someone who's been really generous with his time that I've met through industry, and he's involved with our business, which is really helpful for us. And I guess just being able to reach out to other people in industry in those sort of different positions. You know, sometimes when I'm trying to decide what to do around meat, I'll bring a couple of people who are in processing and be like, where do you think prices are going? You know, what do you reckon? Can you see stuff that I don't know? And then I'm not necessarily even buying from them, but just getting some different opinions out there is always really good too.
Yeah, that's great. From a beef eating experience. Now, this is tricky asking a manufacturer of jerky, but I do like to ask people, what is the best beef eating experience that you've had? And you might like to answer it in two parts, the processed or jerky built on or other beef as well. What comes to mind?
Look, I know I'm probably supposed to say fillet or something, but my comfort food and one from my childhood is corned beef. So I think, you know, everyone gets a couple of corned beef from their killers, and I just have these amazing memories of the, you know, there's a whole process with the cooking of it and, you know, white sauce. And I just, it really invokes this feeling of family and coming together. And look, it's not the most sexy cut of meat either.
But there's flavour.
But it's flavour on it. And it's a way of taking a product and evaluating it into something new as well, which I'm always a fan of. So I actually really enjoy corned beef.
Oh, fantastic. That's a great answer. And then I guess as we finish up, Emily, is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to mention to the Angus community? Maybe anything that we should be thinking about or anything at all, really?
I don't know. I think, look, Angus is probably done the best of any beef, you know, globally around how you've managed to position yourself as a brand. I mean, it's quite amazing to me that everyday consumers who don't know anything about production systems would be able to name an Angus. And I think that's something that you guys should be incredibly proud of, because I don't think any other beef breed has managed that sort of visceral understanding of who you are as a breed. So I think, you know, that's something that's incredibly impressive from a marketing perspective. But I don't know, have a go. If you've got an idea that's a little bit different and, you know, but you believe in it, I think really have a go. There's a really famous Roald Dahl quote, and it's like, if you believe anything, put your heart into it, because lukewarm's no good. And I think that's one that we always try and live with, like, lukewarm is no good, you've got to go.
That's fantastic. That's great. Well, I've really enjoyed our chat this morning. Thank you for your insights and being so open, and thanks for coming to our Wilderness Forum in Brisbane and sharing with that group that morning. I think there was a few dusty people after the gala dinner the night before, so that people on their farms listening to this podcast, they'll be very encouraged and a lot of great insights. But thanks so much, Emily, for your time, and we just wish you all the best for the next chapter of Jim's. We'll have a lot of anticipation to see where this next road takes you.
John, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. And I hope everyone has a good day.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.